Welcome to Becoming Limitless. This is the podcast for entrepreneurs who want to optimize their brain and their body with biohacking. I'm going to teach you how to eliminate brain fog and upgrade your health so you can have more productivity, energy, and growth in your business. I'm your host, Tanessa Shears. Let's jump in. Welcome back to the Becoming Limitless podcast. How have you been? How's everything been going this week? I'm really excited to deliver this episode to you, but also a little hesitant, and I'll tell you why in a little bit. But this episode is basically going to be a two-part series, okay? And I'm breaking it up into two episodes because I know it's going to be a long one because I've got a lot to say, but I want to be talking about controversial things in the health and fitness industry that I have changed my mind on. And I'm going to be sharing with you what I've learned that has caused me to change my mind and how I think differently, what I used to think. And so the reason this all came up was I posted a carousel post on Instagram a while back, and it was all about controversial things that I had changed my mind on, right? And I had reached out to a couple of the people who had engaged with the post, and I was like, can I ask just what resonated about this? And someone wrote back this in my DMs. They said, I appreciate your vulnerability and the way you use your own evidence-based experience. There aren't many pages on Instagram that add true value, but yours does. And it really got me thinking, like, I think that there is purpose in sharing what I am going through and my truth, because I believe that someone that is a leader in their industry has to have willingness and open-mindedness, right? What I never want to do in my business, in my personal life, with my health, is use Instagram, use social groups, use podcasts I listen to create an echo chamber. Now, what I mean is that is like if you open your Instagram and you scroll through and everyone you follow agrees with you, has your same opinion, all your friends think the same, that nobody disagrees with you on anything, you basically created an echo chamber where everything everyone says constantly just reinforces what you already think. But this doesn't really create any opportunity for internal growth, for changing beliefs and opinions. And one of my foundational beliefs has been that I always want to be okay with disagreeing with someone or doing something differently than someone else, but being totally at peace that they can both be right for different people, right? And not thinking that I can't be friends with them if they don't choose the things I do or they don't believe the things I do. So I love to surround myself with controversial opinions, different than my own, people that do life different, they think different, they act different, because that's how I'm going to be exposed to growth, right? So I am always willing to change my mind if I am presented with something that I feel is valid, right? And this also lends to my commitment to continued education. And this is important to me because I mean, it's really interesting. I literally just saw a reel on Instagram and it was talking about that there's this moment when you start in your business and you have all this confidence and then you realize the longer you're in that industry, they're like, oh my gosh, there's so much I don't know. And you go through that maybe imposter syndrome or that confidence shift. And it's like, once you know how much you don't know, the job becomes so much bigger as a leader because it bestows upon you this decision to continue educating yourself. And like my business is 10 years old now, and I have been in the health industry teaching health and fitness for 10 years or for 15 years since, I guess it's 2008. Oh my gosh, that's longer than that. That's 16 years. That's a long time. But I have changed my mind on so many things that I just believed because that was what was told me at the beginning. And so I pair that willingness to change my mind with commitment to continue education, listening to new authority, new research, new experts, and then also using my own evidence-based experience, because I genuinely believe there is a place for that, especially in the health, the mental health industry, is that if something is working for you, that is so important to recognize, even if it's counter what all the quote-unquote gurus say you should and shouldn't be doing. And so much of my experience does come from my background. I've got a bachelor's of science in biomedical physiology and kinesiology, but it also comes from, you know, 10 plus years of working with clients and also on my continual evolution of myself. Like if you've been listening to or been on Instagram or listening to some of the podcast episodes, things I've recently been working on are only having coffee with food and minimizing that over time, like the amount that I'm intaking. I'm working on developing emotional freedom. If you listen to the New Year's episode called Tangible Freedom, right? And so I'm always sharing what I'm working because I think that anybody that wants to be a thought leader in their space must be continually developing this. And where my hesitation comes in sharing this naturally is I think as humans, we all have this desire to be liked. Right? Like we want to be accepted. We want to be included in the group. And so sometimes, and I mean, if you've ever done this in your own content or your own business, you'll identify with this, but stepping out and stating your opinion boldly is terrifying because people on the internet aren't the nicest in the world. And a lot of people don't support or hold space for, you know, alternate or dissenting opinions or feedback, right? It's very much looked at as like, you can only believe this one thing or think this one way, and you're incredibly wrong if you think anything different, right? And I just literally got off of a call with a client where we were talking about this idea of being liked, right? And so it does make it hard to share these opinions. But here's what I shared with her, because, you know, she's going through some stuff with her family right now. And it's, you know, she's worried about what they'll think. Very much just kind of like the thought passed through my brain of like, what if someone like vehemently disagrees with something I say over the next two episodes and is like, we can't be friends anymore because she thinks that she's wrong about everything. Like that goes through your head, right? And part of this is vulnerability, because here's what I shared to my client today is that I would rather be vulnerable and transparent and real with you and have you like or not like me based on who I am rather than who I pretend to be. So if I showed up here and had all these wiffle waffle opinions and just made everything nice and stuff like that, pretended to not rock the boat, that's not me. And so if you like me, you're not actually liking me, you're liking who I'm pretending to be. So in showing up and doing this, I'm being vulnerable, showing you how my brain works, showing you some controversial things I've changed my mind on in hopes that, you know, maybe it'll open up your brain and you'll learn something you didn't know about. If not, you'll also just get to know me. And if I know that if you're, you know, part of my community and you like me, I'll always know that you like me for the authentic version of me and not who I'm pretending to be. So transparency is so important. I didn't mean to start the podcast off with this whole kind of like thought on people pleasing, but it really comes in, especially if you're in a position in your business where you do share. Vulnerability, I think, is appreciated as long as you are willing to allow people to be wrong about you, allow them to be able to think she's wrong and be okay with that. Because I am. I truly am. I believe in these things. They have served me well. And here's the thing. As we're going through these next two episodes, these controversial things in the health and fitness industry that I've changed my mind on, because I say something does not mean you are doing it wrong, right? We can both do the exact opposite things and it can both be perfect. So everything I share here is not meant to be showing you that you're doing it wrong. It is not meant to advise you or tell you that you need to change what you're doing. And also, my beliefs aren't always what I make my clients do. Like you're going to hear through all of these, my clients are never obligated to subscribe to my beliefs, my values, or any of that. So there's a lot of this stuff that I believe in that my clients do. Or thy clients don't do. And that's totally okay. So don't think that like just because you listen to this episode that you now, if you ever work with me, that you'd have to do these things. That is not true, okay? I have clients that do all of these things. These are going to be things that I have changed my mind on. And it likely started from someone telling me something I didn't know and then investigating it myself. So this is an invitation to you to investigate everything I'm sharing with you further to see if it resonates and hit home for you. My goal is just to make you think, to make you ask questions, maybe even to make you feel uncomfortable. Because when someone says something that is contrast to your beliefs and you feel uncomfortable, that's not a sign something's gone wrong. It's a sign to dig. It's not to judge you or tell you my way is right. So I just want to say that right off the bat. So having said that, this whole episode is going to be on controversial things I've changed my mind on. I think I'm planning to cover 6 of them in this episode. And then in the following episode, it is more controversial things I've changed my mind on, but all to do with women's health. So let's jump in to thing number 1. Here is something that I used to recommend and take myself that I no longer do. And it is melatonin. So melatonin is a hormone that you can actually buy on the shelves of a grocery store or a department store. And it is a hormone that you can take in supplement form. Now, most of us believe that melatonin is something that helps us fall asleep or stay asleep longer. But I am a big subscriber to Dr. Matthew Walker. He is like the sleep guru. He wrote the book, Why We Sleep. If you haven't read that, it is a wonderful book. But he basically was going all through these studies that melatonin has been shown in research to only actually increase sleep duration by 4 minutes. 4 minutes. And here's the wild thing. Any dose that you take of melatonin is what is called a supraphysiological dose. It is higher than what is physiologically naturally produced in your own body. It is so far out of the realm of what our body would ever produce, and it is a hormone that you are taking that is designed to signal the onset of sleep, all right? So the doses that we're taking are way, way, way too high. So that is the first red flag. Then I was listening to a podcast episode where Dr. Andrew Huberman interviewed Dr. Matthew Walker, and they were talking about some research that was done actually looking at what effects that this very high dose of melatonin has when given to mice. And what they found was that it suppressed sex hormones. So think estrogen, think testosterone. Because I want you to think about this. Melatonin is naturally high in prepubescent kids because it acts as a puberty suppressor. High melatonin in young kids suppresses puberty from happening. Then when kids go through puberty, their melatonin levels drop. So now when we are taking these hormones exogenously, meaning from the outside, we're taking it as a supplement, it can suppress it can suppress these sex hormones, estrogen and testosterone, and those can have a large amount of effects. And specifically in this study of mice that they were reviewing, when the mouse was administered melatonin, its testicles shrunk from the size of a pea to a grain of rice. Now, this has not been tested in humans, but those two pieces of information alone are enough for me to have tossed out my bottle of melatonin and never recommended it again. So if you are using melatonin as a sleep aid, there are so many more effective, either A, even just supplements, but more effective lifestyle changes that you can make to help with sleep. And if you need help with this, reach out to me on Instagram in the DMs, or you can go to my website, reach out. This is my specialty, and this is what I help entrepreneurs with, is better sleep. Like this, I do this in a one-to-one coaching environment. So definitely feel free to reach out to me on this. So melatonin is one of those things that I have completely changed my mind on. And a lot of people buy into melatonin, think it is great. I don't subscribe anymore. Thing number two, controversial thing that I've changed my mind on, eating a late dinner. Now, back when I was, you know, in my bodybuilding phase, this is probably 6-7 plus years ago, I used to do intermittent fasting very religiously. And we're actually going to be talking about intermittent fasting in the next episode. But intermittent fasting specifically, I used to not eat until 1 or 2 in the afternoon and then eat till 9 or 10 at night, right? You eat for an 8-hour window and then you fast for a 16-hour window, right? And because of how this schedule was set up, that meant I had a very late dinner. So I was often eating my last meal around 8:30, 9 at night. And then I went to bed at 10:30. And there are so many people on the internet that say it's all about calories in, calories out, eating after dark doesn't matter. And like, okay, I can buy into that a little bit, like the energy in, energy out thing, kind of. And we're going to get to that too. But here is what does matter. So you know how, if you've listened to a lot of these podcasts, you may have come across one that talks about blood sugar and how specific foods affect blood sugar. I think even episode like maybe it's 5 and 6 in this podcast go into this really deep. But basically, when you eat foods, specifically processed foods that are high in simple carbohydrates, processed carbohydrates. So basically think of anything with sugar and flour, that will definitely do it. But even some certain fruits like bananas and pineapples and mangoes and stuff like that, there are definitely certainly foods that enter your body, the blood sugar is broken down, it hits your bloodstream and it spikes it up way higher than other foods. So your body then produces this hormone called insulin, and insulin's job, think of it like a little Pac-Man that goes through your bloodstream and like gobbles up all the glucose and delivers it to either the muscles tissues, the liver, or the fat cells for storage, okay? So insulin normally does a pretty good job at doing that, except insulin is not as effective at night. And the problem with that is if you eat, say, I'm just going to use something simple, a piece of bread in the morning and a piece of bread in the night, your insulin will do a better job at getting it into the cells earlier in the day than later in the day. Now, what does this mean? This means that your blood sugar is a lot more unstable and can spike and it's all over the place in the evening. The problem with that is not only are you less insulin sensitive, your blood sugar levels are higher, which can lead to increased inflammation, but it affects your sleep. So many of the clients I work with, they're up in the middle of the night and they have these like recurring 3 a.m., 4 a.m. wake ups. And sometimes that reason is because they either have a massively high blood sugar, which is causing them to wake up and overheat, or they spiked their blood sugar up so high that it's dropping. And now they're getting that bottom out effect and that is causing them to wake up. So while like eating at night, like obviously you're going to find for everything I say in this whole podcast and the next one, you're going to find people that do the exact opposite of this and are living great lives and totally healthy. I get that. But for the majority of people, especially if you retain weight extra that you do not want on your body, that is a good sign that your insulin or your blood sugar might be a little out of balance. But eating late at night, especially those highly processed carbohydrate dense foods, desserts and all of that, your blood sugar can't come as down and it can disrupt your sleep. The other thing, eating a late dinner requires you to digest it. So if you are eating within 3 to 4 hours of going to bed, like the whole purpose of going to sleep is to rest, recharge, recover for tomorrow. It is for your brain to kind of do a reboot to get, you know, all the restorative energy that it needs. But here's the deal. When you are eating right before bed, what happens is your body's like, we got to do something with this food. Like let's focus all our energy on digestion. And when you digest, it is a metabolically active process. Your heart rate has to increase. Your blood pressure has to increase, right? This is the exact opposite of what we want at night. You want your blood pressure to decrease. You want your heart rate to decrease. And so what I will often see is when I'm looking at client data and I monitor their data from an Oura ring, and I can see, if I look at your nighttime heart rate, what I can see, if you ate late or close to bed, and I look at your nighttime heart rate graph, I can see a hill at the beginning of the night. And what that tells me is as you were falling asleep, your heart rate increased to digest the food instead of doing what we want it to do, which is decrease after you go to sleep. So it disrupts the amount of time you get to spend restoring. And the longer you put off reaching a nice, low, stable heart rate, the less time you spend in recovery. So I no longer eat late dinners. I honestly think 99% of the time, the very latest I will eat dinner as I will finish by 6:30 and we do lights out at 9 in our house. But most of the time it's in the 4 to 5 range. And I really like to allow that time for my body to begin shifting into rest and recovery and not have to focus on digestion. So thing number two, I don't do the late dinner and I don't subscribe to those people that say, oh, it doesn't matter if you eat, you know, at night or after dark, because it does. Hey, I've got a question for you. Have you found this podcast helpful? Has it helped you improve your sleep, have more energy, upgrade your health? If it has, would you please consider leaving a 5-star review? It'll only take you 10 seconds. I'd really appreciate it, and it could change someone else's life too. The next controversial thing that I want to talk about is alcohol. And this is one where honestly, everyone's got their opinions on alcohol. So this is one that might rub you the wrong way, but like I said, again, this is just my experience and what I have learned. And I used to drink 3 to 4 days a week in my 20s and it was great and all, but I no longer drink. And I think maybe I have had one like cooler drink in the last 5 years. I pretty much have completely given up alcohol. And the first reason I gave it up, and I've got a whole bunch of reasons, I'm going to walk you through not only personal thoughts and beliefs, but some scientific evidence behind this. The first reason I gave it up was because I was tired of spending so many days of my life feeling like crap. Whether you are mildly hungover, whether you wake up dehydrated, whether you have a tiny bit of a headache, whether your energy's lower or you just don't feel like working out, like I don't want to spend a seventh, meaning one day a week or 2 days a week or 3 days a week of my life, feeling any less than awesome. For me, I just gave myself that gift that I'm going to spend the majority of my life feeling amazing, and it feels great. The second reason is I noticed that alcohol was taking the place as a distractor or numbing emotional stressors. So if you've seen the reel that I've ever put up on Instagram about this, I talk about this alcohol overwhelm loop that we get into. And this is kind of leading into my next point, is that alcohol is a way that many of us use to unwind. We had a stressful day. It was hard. It was emotional. We had the kids. They were screaming all day. Anything like that, right? And a glass of wine or a beer or whatever it is you like to drink, it takes the edge off, right? And that's what I used to think too. I'd go out on the weekends and, you know, kick back after a week of work and stuff like that. And it would be this just distraction. And instead of actually being like, okay, why was my week so overwhelming? Why was it so stressful? Why don't I deal with that? But instead, at the time, I was like, okay, I'm just need an escape. I just need to unwind. It's totally fine. But not realizing that, because I was avoiding the discomfort and the emotional issues that were going on in my life at the time and the anxiety that I was dealing with, I just kept perpetuating the same problem because the alcohol would wear off and the problem would still be there. But since giving up alcohol, I've been able to deal with a lot of the emotional issues in my life and the stressors that were causing me to grab a drink to unwind. And so I have cleared up so much of the heaviness and the negativity in my life, and I just would not want to go back. So this kind of brings in the second part, is like, aside from being able to deal with my emotions, when I started really tracking my sleep and understanding the complexity of sleep and how all these things affect it, I could not believe how much of an effect alcohol has on my REM sleep. REM sleep is rapid eye movement sleep. It is when your brain dreams, and it is essential to your success as an entrepreneur. So just check this out. REM sleep is responsible for your ability to think outside the box and solve big problems. That is basically your job as an entrepreneur, is to solve problems, right? So if you can solve bigger problems, you're going to get paid more. That's just the fact of it, right? And so I didn't want to affect my problem solving skills any further. The next thing it does is it helps you, when you get enough REM sleep, it helps you read people's facial expressions and body gestures better. So as a consultant and a coach, like, I want to watch my client. I want to see when they get uncomfortable. I want to see when something clicks. I want to see when they're having an aha moment or when they don't understand something. Because if my brain in the background is processing this, I'm going to be able to step in and get better results for my clients, ask better questions, pick up on things that I may have missed if my sleep was crap, right? And it gets even better. REM sleep is responsible for your emotional stability. So if you find that you are highly anxious, you're overwhelmed, you feel low or depressed or any negative feeling, did you know that a lack of REM sleep is directly correlated to your ability to swing into increasingly negative emotions? So here's a good example of this. They were shown, all these people in the study were shown pictures of progressively negative images, and the people who were deprived of REM sleep had much more extreme emotional responses than the people who had enough REM sleep. What this basically means is that your ability to stay calm, cool, and collected is compromised when you don't get enough REM sleep. So I want to always be in integrity in my business and react as my higher self, not out of an emotional response because I didn't get enough REM sleep. Now, alcohol has a massive multi-day effect on REM sleep, meaning it decreases it not just for one day, but can have an effect 3 to 4 days post-alcohol. On top of that, heart rate variability, which is your body's measurement of if it's in fight or flight or rest or digest, it also goes in the toilet, which basically means you put your body into a low-grade state of fight or flight for 2, 3, 4 days. Your resting heart rate also goes through the roof. What this means is that your body is working hard. It is overworking all night long. So you basically have put this stressor on your body that can last 3 to 4 days. And now it's really easy just to pretend it's not a big deal when you're not looking at the data and how your body is being affected on the inside. And for me, it was too much of a thing, because even if you're having a drink every 3 or 4 nights, that is almost just enough to stay in a perpetually low state of fight or flight. And for me, that just wasn't it. And so these are the things that I noticed personally. Now, if we start getting into the science side of it, there's an associated risk with increased cancer, particularly breast cancer. And I thought this stat was fascinating. For every 10 grams of alcohol you consume, there is a 4 to 13% increase in the risk of breast cancer, which is insane, right? Like, that's a big risk. That feels big to me, right? And I find that, like, having worked with clients, like, one of the things I always encourage is, like, if you want to drink, that's up to you, but I encourage you to experiment and see what it is like having had both experiences of having less alcohol or no alcohol, or, you know, maybe just limiting the amount of drinks. Like, experiment with it, see. And I can't tell you how many clients, once they have seen the effect on their data and felt a reduced consumption of alcohol, see their life very differently and recognize how much they were leaning on it to manage their feelings, to deal with their stress, to deal with their overwhelm, to feel social, to get over social anxieties, right? And we were able to, like, once you can solve those crux problems, you don't need to put the Band-Aid on it anymore, right? You can just deal with the underlying issue, right? And to lean into the science part a little bit more, like, alcohol, we know it's a toxin, right? It passes into all types of cells and tissue in your body because it is water soluble and fat soluble. That means it can go into fat tissue and it can go into non-fat tissue. And this heavily stresses and damages these cells and breaks them down. And damaged cells are the ones that put us at risk for cancer, right? And on top of that, alcohol increases the conversion of the hormone testosterone to estrogen. And what can happen here is if you get higher and higher levels of estrogen, we naturally see a spike in estrogen-related cancers and other, you know, negative effects like decreased sex drive, for example, if you're not having enough testosterone, right? Increased fat storage because estrogen is too high. Abnormal growth of breast tissue in males. This may even contribute to estrogen-dominant-related things like PCOS and endometriosis and all of this. So I can't tell you how many reasons I have now that alcohol does not have a fit in my life. And so this is something that a controversial hot take, and I've changed my mind on it now. And this is just not a lifestyle I ever see myself going back to. All right, next one. Controversial things I've changed my mind on. The whole calories in, calories out myth. What this is that I'm saying all of us probably at some point bought into this fitness industry garbage myth that calories in and calories out math is accurate. Meaning if I eat 2,000 calories and I burn 3,000 calories, I'll lose 1,000 calories of weight, right? And we think that just works like that. Like, we expect that our body just works so perfectly that we can just do that math in MyFitnessPal, grab our, you know, calorie output off the treadmill or our smartwatch or something like that. We just, like, buy into this concept that makes sense. And while I'm not negating that this matters, like, if you want to lose weight, there probably does need to be some level of calorie deficit, or if you want to put on muscle, some level of calorie excess. However, thinking that the math works like that is short-sighted, in my opinion. Because here's just a couple stats. And keep in mind, right, I've got the background in biomedical physiology and kinesiology, which means I took the longabout route. I got 100 billion certificates on the side and I, you know, took every course I didn't need. But basically, I took six years to finish my degree. So I studied this stuff extensively. And I'm going to tell you something. Did you know that food logging, so that good old MyFitnessPal app that all the, you know, coaches on the internet have you logging your macros and your calories in, food logging is up to 25% inaccurate. It could be overestimating by 25 or underestimating by up to 25%. That is a 50% spread in inaccuracies, right? And that's not even including, like, if you're weighing your food, or what if the manufacturer label is off, like it, or you chose the wrong thing in MyFitnessPal, even if you scanned it, you know what I mean? There are so many places for error. That's on the calories in portion. Now, when we talk about calories out, it's all predicted based on a formula, whether it's from your Oura Ring, whether it's from your smartwatch, whether the treadmill is telling you. All of these calories that it is telling you are burning is predicted on a simple formula that takes into account your age, your gender, your height, and your weight. But here's the thing. I want you to picture two 150-pound women. Is it possible that one might be a power lifter that has a ton of muscle that is metabolically active, or someone who is 150 pounds that is 5'10" versus a 5'2"? Do you see that there are a lot of factors that go into this? Like how much of that is bone? How much of that is muscle mass? Because muscle is very metabolically active. You are going, if you have more muscle than someone who is your same height and weight, you are going to burn more daily calories, right? So this whole idea that we can take a guess at how many calories we're burning is just a complete simple formula based on some superficial data and has nothing to do with us or the speed of our metabolism or our muscle level or anything like that. Like, here's another thing that blew my mind. Did you know, like, you know how you go on the treadmill or the elliptical or whatever like that and you get off and it tells you, oh yeah, you burned 130 calories? Did you know that unless you are entering all of that data that we just talked about, age, gender, height, and weight, did you know that 90% of treadmills are set to do calorie output for a 180 pound, 5'10" Caucasian male? So even if you have an ethnicity difference, like if you aren't white, all of these formulas are based on the body composition of the average white person. There are different cultures that are heavily muscled, for example, right? And so all of these formulas are often, it's fascinating to me that knowing this now, we just look at this like it's like the rule, like there could be no other way, right? And this is actually what brought this into clarity. I read a book called The Obesity Code by Dr. Jason Fung, and he goes off about why exercise is like a terrible way to lose weight. But it was during this time, and actually it was right around the time my sister did an Ironman. And if you don't know what an Ironman is, it's a race where you basically swim for 3.8 kilometers, you run, you bike 180 kilometers and you run a marathon. Is it like 42 kilometers or something? Like, it's extreme. It's impressive as heck. And I went to the event and I witnessed the athletes in this event. And here is something I really want you to consider. An Ironman athlete leading up to competition will train 6 hours a day, right? And the event itself can be anywhere from, you know, the average winners come in at 8.5, 9 hours to all the way up. I think they cut you off at like 16 hours. You can't finish after that or something like that. But you're doing cardio for a long time, which means you have to do a lot of training for a long time. And as I'm watching this race, I'm watching all these athletes run by, and something I'm noticing, I saw more different body types in that single race than I've seen anywhere else. There were what you would think of as like the stereotypical runner's body, like super lean and low muscled. There was heavily muscled people. There were people that were in shape, people that were out of shape. Now, if we do the calorie math, I hope you could hear the quotation marks around that, doing 6 hours of cardio per day should have had all those people looking like bean poles. But that wasn't the case. There were all kinds of body shapes there, which shows you that if calories out and exercise and calories in were the only things that mattered, everyone should have been super thin. But that's not. We got to look at your hormones. You got to look at your estrogen, progesterone balance. You got to look at your testosterone, your cortisol. You got to look at all these hormones, your insulin. More matters than calories in, calories out. All right. And this is what I really want you to understand is like when you temporarily cut your calories and reduce it, your body doesn't like shut down calorie output. You keep producing and burning natural calories, right? It's the chronic deprivation of calories over time, which can really screw up your metabolism, right? Same thing with overeating. Like we literally think like, oh my gosh, I ate 200 calories too much. I've got to go exercise and make up for it. Well, your body is flexible. You don't have a set amount of calories you burn every day, right? Sometimes you fidget more. Sometimes you walk more. Sometimes you sit more. If you are stressed out, you burn more calories, right? So when you naturally eat more, your body does ramp up what's called NEAT, N-E-A-T, non-exercise activity thermogenesis. It ramps it up so that you start fidgeting more to accommodate the extra eating. Your body is smart. It doesn't follow basic math, right? So, I mean, given how many years I was a personal trainer, I never, no longer, and especially when I was doing weight loss coaching, I do not prescribe exercise for fat loss. It is slow. It is ineffective. You will get frustrated. I prescribe exercise for mental health and for body recomposition. If you want to put on some muscle, if you want your arms to look better, if you want to lift your butt, if you want to feel good, if you want to relieve stress, have at it. But I do not use exercise as like a tool for weight loss. So I hope by now I have given you something to think about with that. That is one pedestal that I stand on very firmly. All right, we're going to do two more in this episode. So the next thing that I have completely changed my mind on is drinking tea from tea bags. This one is actually one that I've changed my mind on maybe in the last like 3 months. So we already know that, like, for the most part, and if you don't know this, you'll know it now. We don't want a microwave in plastic. We don't even want to honestly be putting plastic on the lower rack of the dishwasher, even the upper rack. Like, plastic in the dishwasher allows it to leach microplastics, right? And allows it to leach compounds into the food that we eat. So we know, like, naturally, many of us don't no longer microwave in plastic, for example, or cook in using plastic utensils or plastic containers and anything like that. But did you ever think about the tea bags, right? Like, specifically, even like the plasticky-based, nylon-based tea bags where we, you know, put it in our cup and we are having this experience where we're giving ourselves, you know, maybe some healthy chamomile tea to wind down, right? But there was a study out of McGill. And when tea bags are steeped in hot water, it releases something called a microplastic and an even smaller nanoplastic particle. And when the study at McGill was done, they were testing the actual tea for like levels of microplastics and nanoplastics. And it found that one single tea bag could contain and release up to 11.6 billion of these particles into your cup of tea. And they are the size of dust. So, I mean, this is so far beyond and much more than what is found in other foods and other beverages. And so I am like vehemently against tea bags now. And the switch that I made is to loose leaf teas. And I get, there's like these little stainless steel balls that are, I don't even know what, I'm looking at mine right now. It's like they're netted stainless steel balls. They're called tea balls anyways. And they're kind of like diffuser strainers. So you put loose leaf tea in there and you hang it off the side of your mug and it allows the tea to steep, but it's in stainless steel. So it's not leaching microplastics into anything, right? And so that was a big change that I have made. But more on that, I also took a look and upgraded to organic loose leaf tea because I didn't even know this, but like with coffee and tea, there's actually a lot of mold in these products. And so you're wanting to make sure that you're getting organic, like high altitude stuff. I honestly went on Amazon and I was looking for like local companies that sourced organic loose leaf teas. I'm testing out a chamomile that I got from a local Whole Foods store. And I'm testing out an organic loose leaf green tea. And I gotta say, love it so far. Great. Great find. And then one last thing on this that I just like literally dawned on me while I was making this change is that there was one day I was looking at my kettle, like the kettle, meaning the thing that heats up hot water, and it was made of plastic. And I was like, why would someone make a kettle of plastic? Like that is literally, how many years have I been leaching plastics from my kettle? So I went out, switched it. I bought a glass and stainless steel kettle. I'm making the changes one at a time. All right, we're rounding up on the last of our topics for this episode on controversial things I've changed my mind on. And I want to talk to you about environmental toxins. Now, this was something that like it was on my periphery for a long time, but it was one of those like next step things that I kept learning about. And this is the year I've decided I'm not ignoring it anymore. And I started looking at all of the chemicals that are in the products that we cook with, that we put on our skin, that we put in our hair, that we rub on our bodies, and starting to really understand how saturated our environments are in these toxins. So last year was the year that we decided to remove so many of these. So I'm just going to give you an idea of some of the ones that have been brought into my awareness. So aluminum in deodorant. Now, if you look at 99% of drugstore deodorants and antiperspirants, they have something called aluminum in them, but aluminum actually blocks the sweat pores from allowing sweat out, which can accumulate. And there have been so many studies linked to this aluminum and breast cancer. And so I know the internal struggle that I have had with this is like, most natural deodorants suck, if I'm going to be straight honest with this. But one that I have found was recommended by my sister and it's working. It's from the company Sage, and it's a spray on, and it works not bad. It works not bad. But there's actually an Instagram account I want to share with you guys. One of my friends actually started an Instagram account It's called Low Tox Canadian, and that's her handle right now on Instagram, at Low Tox, L-O-W-T-O-X Canadian. And if you're not Canadian, I'm sure the products are very similar. And she just recently flipped her account over to this kind of account, and she does all kinds of natural product recommendations, like healthier swaps you can make. And so, for example, while we're on the topic of deodorants, she gave, let's see here, there's 9 different recommendations for brands of deodorant that don't include things like baking soda. They don't include the aluminum and all of that kind of stuff. And so these are great. You can just go to her page, click on this. This is what I've been doing, and upgrading things one at a time. You're able to just, you know, order them off Amazon, go to your local natural store. But she does them on a whole bunch of things. Like, she's done them on mascaras and diaper bombs and body lotions and shampoos and baby washes, detergents, like so many little simple swaps. So I'll make sure to drop her Instagram handle actually in the description so you can go check her out. But I'm always learning and referring to her on the healthy whole food the healthy product swaps. Another one that we knocked out this year was frying pans that are not cast iron or stainless steel. Now, I didn't even know this, but you know how I would say 90% of frying pans are coated with Teflon, right? That's the thing that makes it not sticky, right? So you can make your eggs and it doesn't stick and all kinds of stuff like that. Well, there was actually a byproduct that was used in the making of this Teflon nonstick coating that it was in manufacture up until 2013. And it turns out that that chemical that was used to manufacture Teflon was being dumped into this upstream river, and it was linked to kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis, high cholesterol. And did you know that the company that makes Teflon was assessed a $671 million fine for dumping this because of how toxic it was? Now, I get that this was only used to make Teflon, and they've stopped using it since then, obviously, but like, how long did people use Teflon before they figured that out? Who is saying that the company is now using something so much more ethical, right? Like, Teflon has been one of those things I don't touch anymore. So we replaced all of our frying pans with cast iron or stainless steel. In our house, we chose all cast iron. So really looking at the pans that you are cooking on and what they are leaching into your food, what you are putting into your body, your family's body, so important. We already touched on microwaving in plastic or overheating plastic. If you can, stick to glass food prep containers and stuff like that. That is going to make such a difference, and you're not leaching that. And then the other big route that I've been going down with environmental toxins is the garbage chemicals that have been put in our lotions, our shampoos, our baby products, our laundry detergent, our soap, all of this kind of stuff. And there are certain chemicals, and like, keep in mind, there's lots of chemicals, but there are 4 big chemicals that I now flip over every label and look for. So here is number 1. Parfum, P-A-R-F-U-M. Look for it on the label. This basically means they have added a scent to the product, okay? Parfum, basically, there's been studies that have shown that adding scent to products is an endocrine disruptor. It can screw with your body's levels of hormones. If your estrogen gets too high, for example, it can lead to PCOS. It can lead to endometriosis. It can lead to hormone-related cancers. There are so many things. So anything that has parfum in it, skip. The other thing, phthalates, and that is spelled P-H-T-H. Yes, P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S, phthalates. You want to skip products with this. The next one, parabens, P-A-R-A-B-E-N-S, parabens. Flip over your labels, take a look. The last one, toluene, T-O-L-U-E-N-E. Now, I can tell you that every one of my lotions and shampoos had parfum, phthalates, and parabens in it when I first flipped them over. So you're likely going to find them. Toluene specifically, I actually learned in university that toluene is found in nail polish. And I remember I took organic chemistry, and I remember after learning what toluene was and what it does, I have not painted my nails since university. So that was like 15 years ago, long time ago. But yes, so that is basically the chemicals that I would look for. The last things that I'm becoming really aware of is the pesticides, sprayed on our food, so not organic foods. So this year, over the last like couple years actually, we've been systematically upgrading to pretty much only organic foods because we want to make sure that we're reducing the spray that is being sprayed all over our foods. And I totally get the argument that like, hey, well, what if your organic crop is next to a non-organic crop? Isn't there going to be cross spray? Yes, but I want to be doing what I can and what is within my control. And if I can make the choice to choose products that are not directly sprayed, I know that's going to be one step better for me. So like I said, environmental toxins, I am doing my best to systematically change them out. When I finish a bottle of shampoo, I move on to a new one. When we finish our laundry detergent is almost done, that's the next thing to go. I'm doing these things one at a time as the products run out, and it makes the change feel so much more doable. Now, I did do two other podcast episodes on environmental toxins. If you want to check those out, episode 92 is Invisible Environmental Toxins with Ryan Blazer. Specifically in that episode, we talk about the garbage scented products like scented candles, those little Glade plugins, and how toxic they are to our environment. And we cover mold in there. So episode 92 is all of the toxins in our environment, including like dust, stale environments. If you live in a, if you don't open your windows, it's such a good episode. So I had, basically he's like a home biologist and he came on the podcast to talk about this. It's episode 92, Invisible Environmental Toxins. And then he also came on for the subsequent episode, and we talked about the hidden dangers of EMFs. So those are electromagnetic frequencies, a lot of the waves that are coming off of our electronics and what you can do to mitigate the effects of these. And that is actually episode 93, the episode directly after that. So how are we feeling right now? I'm so curious. Are you feeling like inspired? Are you like, yeah, I got some things I want to change? Are you feeling like this has been confronting for you? Do you disagree? I'm so interested because I love this idea that you can do something different than I can do. We don't have to agree and we can still be friends. But I feel like with the platform that I have and the education that I have and the commitment I have to the betterment of health of myself, my family, and my community and my clients, like I want to share this stuff. Okay, so today we covered, I don't subscribe to melatonin anymore. I'm a heck no on eating late dinner. Keep in mind, this is not all the time. There are still several like special occasions where I'll eat late, but as a rule, not an exception. Alcohol, I'm a no to. The whole calories in, calories out mentality, nope. Drinking from tea bags, nope. Environmental toxins, nope. Also working on eliminating those. So like I said, I hope this has kind of been fun. Next episode coming out, we are continuing the controversial things I have changed my mind on, and I have got five for you in that episode, and they are all to do with women's health. Like this has been such an area of excitement and passion for me lately, just really digging into my cycle and my hormones and how the things I'm doing and eating and consuming and being around are affecting my hormones and giving me less peace, less health, less energy. So I'm showing you things in that episode that I don't do anymore that has been for the benefit of my health. And we're talking mostly about hormones, cycles, PMS, all of that kind of stuff. So tune into that episode. That'll be out in the next episode. That'll be episode 114 on the Becoming Limitless podcast. I hope you have a really beautiful week. And I'd love to hear, like, do you agree with any of these? Do you disagree with any of them? I'm always open for a good conversation, a respectful, level-headed conversation where we exchange alternate ideas and opinions. Like, hit me up on Instagram. Let's have a talk. You know I love a good amount of discomfort. Right? So I hope you do too. And I hope you invite in some alternate ideas and opinions this week. Have a beautiful week, you guys. I'll talk to you next time. Bye. Ready to begin each day feeling energized and focused? I'd love to work with you one-on-one. In my Becoming Limitless program, you're going to learn how to optimize your brain and body with science and biohacking so you can be highly productive and grow your business faster. Join me over at TanessaShears.com/work with me. I'll see you there.